Okay.
So we have a different sort of panel. We have someone in the audience, Leslie Greengard, who's a mathematician. He applied back in the spring from the course. Didn't know anything really about our field, but was very interested in that. So we've asked him to chair this panel of the rest of us, I guess, to maybe put us in new directions or discuss topics that are current. It's up to you now.
Oh, you want it? What's this? Okay.
So, if you guys just pass that between
so you.
Thanks.
Want to run we'll do the this. Mic or you going to...
No, I think we'll just have people talking. So my plan was not to show slides or do anything like that. I mean, I think there's been enough questions about the mathematical issues that there will be a fruitful panel without my doing that, and I have backup questions if there's moments of silence. Yes.
Okay, we have something to put on.
It's even on. So I have a kind of nasty question, mostly for the audience. With all of these programs, and you have somebody who's just starting up a lab or something, which of these programs is the easiest to use for a novice in any sense you want to consider it, meaning easy to get it to do something, avoids mistakes? I thought maybe people in the audience would comment, or you could comment.
Relion is really cool, and Eman is easy to use. I think it's between you guys.
I also think Freeline works very nicely.
I just want to throw in XMIP. I'm sorry. The XMIP. XMIP. Not just as a program and a breeding ground for very clever algorithms, but also the idea of the Scipion. Scipion is a platform which allows many different packages to coexist and makes the interconversion possible.
And so does Appion, I understand. I think Relion is a pain to use because you have to use a big cluster, and that's quite difficult to set up in many labs. So high-performance computing is something which causes a lot of headaches. So,
well, in conjunction with this, there is this promise of 50 times accelerated speed through the algorithms that were introduced at Yale. Do we know, do we have any update? When is this going to be available?
Yeah. So Nietzsche has a poster on this. It's not that complicated. I think you guys, or I think Shores could put it into Relion pretty easily. it's a speed up of the maximum likelihood by basically compressing the images and compressing the volumes into a lower dimensional space.
I think that's not so easy. It's a compression on, it's acceleration of the real space maximum likelihood approach. And one reason you can accelerate that a lot is because people usually oversample their data a lot, so they use a much smaller pixel size than what you actually need for alignment and classification. Because Relion works in the Fourier domain, things are very, very different. And just working on lower Fourier components is part of that actual speed up, which is already done in Relion. So
the theory works in Fourier space, but maybe we'll talk about this.
So I think I have the next question. So in X-ray crystallography, disordered atoms, just by nature of the beast, just disappear. in EM, they seem to be there, and they're causing heterogeneity. So if we have a structure from EM, and there's all these multiple conformations, should the default then be to just classify them out? And anytime we have, and is this kind of the mystery barrier that secondary structure movement is a certain amount of loss of resolution, and then will it go on to where we classify out side chains, or and does that not limit cryo-EM?
So you're asking where the limits are, I guess. So I don't think side chains can be classified as, I suspect, I don't know, always. Sure. I mean, any heterogeneity that you mix together will lead to a loss of detail in that area.
And so then right now, is it movement in secondary structure, alpha helices, beta sheets, that is that limit that we're facing right now? And so then doesn't it come down to just classification and that we will push?
Yes. So I would say every project will benefit from classification, as far as I can tell. So it's either by getting rid of things that don't align for some reason, or by separating true different states.
So then if I have an area of that's not very good resolution, the first go-to thing should be to try to classify it out, and that'll fix
right.
The...
Yes, but there's something that I think resolution hides a little bit. It happens frequently that after classification, your individual classes have Fourier calculations that are indicate a lower resolution than before. And how can that happen? So when you have a ribosome, for example, where most of the particle does not move, let's say, and you have a little bit that does move, then most of the Fourier calculation is determined by the big part that is homogeneous. And after classification, you will have divided this into two smaller classes, and the overall resolution indicated by the Fourier calculation may well be lower, although you will see more detail in that part that was previously blurred. So it's a little, you have to be careful with these resolution assessments and what they tell you.
I think that directly leads to local resolution variation. So we now often use many different maps when we interpret our reconstruction. So the best ordered parts we use reconstructions from all particles together and their higher resolution, and then parts that flop around, we do classification and we interpret that at lower resolution. And I think in that whole analysis of local resolution of a given reconstruction, I think the RASMAP program from Alp Kuku Chibir and Hemant Tagare from Yale is a beautiful tool to have a look at that.
Hi. May I?
Yeah.
Thanks. So you guys were talking about 2D, 3D maximum likelihood classification, and I was wondering if you can elaborate a little bit about that in terms of if you can do 3D maximum likelihood classification, does that also mean that it can be applicable to, let's say, subtomogram averaging, and how hard it is to do that in that case?
Yep. That will be rely on 1.4.
What do we add
now? 1.3. So this will happen.
So just to clarify that, does that essentially mean that we will be able to do subtomogram averaging without template matching?
Ah, that's a good question. In some cases, yes, and in other cases, no. I think it will all depend on signal-to-noise ratio in your data. I think there is already tools out there that allow it to do it without references, and sometimes you do need a reference. So it's not a magic bullet, the regularized likelihood approximation.
Just want to mention that the part of the project with the people in Wisconsin is to tackle subtomograms. So indeed, this kind of tool will be applied to it, and that would be completely reference free.
That would be really, really great. If I may, just one more short question. Shores, you were talking about the B factor weighing, and you said that it probably will be useful for structures at lower end of the resolution, in terms of, sorry, higher resolution. When would you think it would be most helpful? At which?
The B factor weighting will help, because B factors have stronger effects at higher resolution, the effects will be biggest at high resolution. And it's difficult to estimate reliable B factors from low resolution reconstructions. In our lab, we've just done a 7-angstrom structure, and it still helped, so it went from 8.5 to 7 or so. But we just see that you have to kind of keep it by the hand much more, because you have to be careful with these B factors and perhaps do running averages of frames and so on. So it can work, but it works much easier out of the box if you have a 4-angstrom map, and somewhere in between it kind of becomes more difficult.
Here.
Yes. Yeah, so it was sort of a follow-up with respect to the B factor weighting and comparison of that versus electron dose weighting based on, like, Tim's and Nico's models. I mean, that would seem to, at least for all the, not the, what's happening in the first few frames, but all the rest, that would seem to be a general strategy that could work independent of resolution. Do you think that underestimates what the B factor is, or is that actually pretty reliable as a general approach?
Yeah, I think in the end we want to converge to something like that, where you have some kind of a physical model and apply that to your data, because especially what I mentioned earlier one of these days, that getting rid of your movies very quickly is a very good idea. And now we kind of drag them along and it clogs our disks. So I think we'll just use it, learn, and somehow get to learn from these B factors. That's our plan, to learn from these plots and hopefully at some point make some predictive model.
Given the kind of noise in your B factor plots, does that imply that they're, is that real variation for some reason, or is that in fact noise, and that we'd do better with something that would be some smooth behavior over time, Nico's and Tim's?
One of the hand-taking approaches that I just mentioned, if the resolutions aren't so high, if you see this plot is very noisy, but you can kind of see the overall effect, you can actually tweak the program. You can fit your own curve through it and put that back into the program. So that is an option.
How are we going to, there are, a few, I guess, if you... Oh, sorry.
Sorry, just getting back to the previous question. Like, you refine maps, like, piece by piece, so that you get the best resolution in each part of the map. So now the question is, what do we deposit in the EMDB? Do we send them all our maps, which would make sense, but then we might want to update a little bit the MDB?
That's a very good question. I think every map that's really important for building certain parts might be useful to submit, but that's a community discussion, I think.
Okay. How are we going to tell, how are we going to get the most accurate models, atomic models, out of the data? And how are we going to know how accurate they are? And I'll just make a comment, it seems to me that we should, in refinement, we should go back as close as we can get to the observation we make experimentally. I know now people are looking at maps and saying, here is our representation of data. But in a sense, I guess we have to go back. We should be refining against a particle stack or perhaps image. We have to decide whether what, you know, what the errors are, what the unknowns are in all of the things we measure, CTF, aspects of the microscope, and should those ultimately, should we be refining the model considering that? So it seems to be a pretty interesting problem because as we see the signal to noise, which is everything, is quite low in these measurements. So how do you see this all developing?
Maybe I just want to add on to it. I have a question to Sjors. Does the particle polishing return something that could be useful in this context?
Okay. Let me give my opinion, okay? And then let's see. I think this will develop either very slowly or not at all. But I have the same discussion with Gary Murshidov, who writes RAFMAC, right? He's a crystallographer here. He says we should refine against our data. So from a broad philosophical point, I think you're completely right. And you have a model that interprets your data, and you should refine against the raw data. From a practical point of view, I think it will take a while because the alignments are driven by these very low frequencies. Many particles around 20 angstroms, and then alpha helices kick in, you start aligning against 10 to 9 angstroms, and then after that, there's usually not much information in individual particle images to drive alignment. Whereas the forward models that we have, that we generate from PDB models into images, aren't at all that good at those frequencies. So, but that's perhaps a practical obstacle to something which we should achieve, but I think it will take a while. I don't know what Nico and Steve.
Yeah, I wonder how useful this really will be, because at least at the moment, I think it's not so clear how atomic models need to be converted to reflect everything that goes on in the microscope. And the only thing that I can see where an atomic model helps is in scaling the amplitudes, but you can do that, I guess, at the end of your refinement.
Well, in a broad perspective, I would say we have to know what we know and know what we don't know, and this is always true in science, right? I know it seems like a hard problem, but we have to aim to try to get the most accurate interpretation of the data.
So one thing we've tried a couple of times is if you're at a resolution where you're beginning to see side chains and you're not sure and you think you want to try and refine things a little bit more, is take your model, strip off all the side chains, then put that in as an initial model and refine again and see what side chains come back. And you can do that in various ways, maybe using one of Powell's bootstrapping strategies or something, and sort of see how much variation you see in the side chains that we return when you do that sort of thing. And that gives you a way of letting your model sort of bias you gently, without biasing you in a way that's going to impact your interpretation. You know the side chains are coming out of the data because you didn't put them in the model. I'm not claiming that that's a solution to the question you're raising, but it's very difficult to refine against raw data. I mean, I agree with Shor's point. It's each image has so much noise that the precision with which you have to do all of those calculations makes it such that any tiny little error in your mathematical reasoning can lead to catastrophic results. So it's a very tricky thing to get right.
I mean, and maybe computation with computation on molecules will get better and better, so then we could reach the point where as long as we can get some within some radius of convergence on the structure, then we don't have to worry about that anymore. If we could, I know we're very far from that, but maybe that's what will happen. We just have to get a structure that is close enough, and then we can calculate.
So following up on Rod's point, I mean, I think that one of the things that I was struck by that's not done, and I think it's because we're CPU bound in this community, is the inability to bootstrap the final structure. I mean, if whatever your processing is, do it. You know, leave out 20% of your data, do it again, do that 1,000 times. If you could do that computationally, it didn't take 3 months to do each one, you'd have a very large data set from which you could compute confidence intervals around the structures you're getting. And the only reason, as far as I can tell, from 2 days in this business, that people don't do it is that bootstrapping is too expensive to do as a brute force matter right now, and people don't have a clean alternative. Is that wrong?
I think Puddle's in your talk on that for a moment.
Well, they are...
I talked to him on the side, but he's not doing what I just said. Not a full bootstrap on the full data.
Okay. Okay. Is it not sufficient to do a 3D variance estimation, which is Powell's method, and also there are other approaches? Yeah.
There are concerns of model bias with this.
The unbiased version is, I mean, it's one of the few good ideas that's appeared in statistics in decades. That's really an unbiased estimator.
I wanted to make a comment on Rod's point, which is, Shores, if you're doing Bayesian estimation of each voxel of your map, why couldn't you do Bayesian estimation of each angle, you know, each atom position in the molecule instead? You could, it's about the same number of variables, EM estimation.
I think you could. It has a beautiful potential for incorporating prior knowledge about structures into your reconstruction process. I'm only saying it will be practically challenging, and it will take a while, but it might happen. For example, currently, if something is floppy, we'll reconstruct a fuzzy cloud around one part of our molecule where something is flopping about. Now, if you refine a molecule, that can't happen, so because there is atoms or there is no atoms, and that's what really happens in our proteins as well. So that kind of prior knowledge, you could somehow also express in a...
You want to know what's the ensemble of structures.
Yes.
Consistent with your raw data.
Yes. So the good thing about refining an atomic model would be that an atomic model is forced to then go into all those clouds, whereas something we do now, which is just reconstructing a fuzzy thing, doesn't express any prior knowledge about how proteins look like. So it's an advantage, potential advantage of refining atomic models, apart from restraints and so on that we all know.
Yeah, I mean, the challenge is getting in the right local minimum so that you actually have some, you know, because the convergence radius is not going to be huge, right? And so the stepwise approach helps give you a much larger radius of convergence than if you started with a polypeptide chain and trying to fit it into all your projection views.
Yes,
right?
Fold that up will be a challenge.
I just wanted to comment briefly on Leslie's suggestion. So actually, a strategy similar to what you suggest is implemented in Sparks. I showed the general principle at the Gordon conference earlier this year. This is not finished yet, so I won't be showing it this time, but it's very close to completion.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear it.
My question is actually on a completely different topic, so if people want to continue this, that might be.
I first have to preface it that I'm sometimes a little bit slow, but I'd like to return to the question about that I interpret as being... basically cross-validation or refinement against structure factors. So the question that was asked in a couple of responses, one knows how to do, comparing, validating against the data or something. We know how to do that in X-ray crystallography. And is that correct? Did I get the panel to nod assent? The thing you were saying was too complicated to do in electron microscopy and it'll take a while before we can do it. It's easy to do in X-ray crystallography, right? Fred is allowing me to proceed. All right. So single molecule reconstruction can be described as taking single molecules and crystallizing them in a computer rather than physically crystallizing them biochemically. The process of alignment and orientation assignment is three-dimensional crystallography. So once we feel we've finished that and we want to now know how good it is, we can treat the data the same way as we would X-ray crystallography data. Does that solve the problem? To my simple mind, I think it does, but I'd like to know what your reaction is to it, to my suggestion. It looks like the reaction is befuddlement.
Rod, you're asking something different, right?
No, it's the very same question.
Right.
In what is pointed out here is the implied is a signal to noise issue, and of course in a typical crystal we have something like a billion molecules, and so one way to help is if we could have a billion single particles to, I mean, there is a difference. He's raising the very same, stating this very same problem.
It's just to clarify, Bob, to answer your question and partially yours, the problem is not so much with the signal-to-noise ratio of the data, but the fact that EM data has many more degrees of freedom. X-ray amplitudes don't have any degrees of freedom. Yes, they're just what they are, and arrangement is known. Our data has multiple degrees of freedom, even after you solve the structure, because we don't really know the accurate positions of projections. So this strategy cannot work.
I agree that the point Paul makes is correct, but I go back to the point that whatever complications we have, we finally wind up with we've translationally aligned and orientationally assigned molecules. We have created in the computer a crystal of, in our case, 30,000 protein structures or 100,000. We've created a crystal. We now want to ask, how good was that crystallization? Is it as good as a biochemical one? Or in some cases, we're claiming it's even better than a biochemical crystallization.
Bob, I'm trying to understand what is helpful in this analogy. Because as Paul pointed out, we have an overwhelming number of additional parameters. And even if we declare one population as good enough to push for a Nature publication, then we still have the potential of an enormous number of conformational changes.
Those are going to be present, and they're going to ruin the quality of our crystal. That's okay. We just want to know how bad has it been ruined.
I think there is a bit of a misunderstanding. Because I think what Rod means is to make the map better using coordinate, or not having a map, basically. No. Refine atomic coordinates with respect to the data.
I started it with the accuracy of the atomic model.
Oh, okay.
I'm talking about ultimately what we're after is understanding the biology and the chemistry, right? And what I'm asking is, how do we take these data and get as accurately as we can?
So you mean
in terms of our molecular description or our atomic description, or at whatever level we can, how can we make it as accurate as possible? And how can we validate? How can we know how accurate it is? How can we end up knowing what we know and what we don't know?
Okay, so I think that's model building. I think that's the subject of tomorrow's, if I understand. But
and validation of that is different from getting the best possible map. So if it's about constructing a model inside a given reconstruction, and that's, I understand also what Bob spoke about, so you are in Greek, I was confused, okay, sorry. Then there... Hmm? Yes. Yes, that's what I thought. Okay, but that's way ahead of us because of the and that's what Nico thought and Joachim thought, because complexity there is enormous. So I don't think we want to go there for a while. If it's just about model building, I think we need better tools, especially also for auto building somehow. We spend way more time building a model than we actually do sitting at a microscope or processing an image. And validating it is also very important topics. I think part of it will be discussed tomorrow, right? So.
Yeah, I guess I would say, I mean, cutting through map model, I would say, how can we know what we know and what we don't know, and how do we get as much information as we can? And this comment about going back to, I think always we should be doing our best to compare with the observation we make, with the experimental observation. And of course, I know by asking this, I'm asking a really hard question because of the signal to noise here, but I think it seems to me that's what ultimately we have to do. Whenever we make a model, we do an experiment and we have a model about what's going on, we go back and ask, how well does that model predict our observation?
Let me just add another comment. I think we probably can't go a whole lot further with this today, but you know, you can view the molecular mechanics model, if you will, that's basically used when you're building crystal structures, actually is a reduced conformational space to explore. So if you sort of restrict your cryo-EM map to produce something which is considered valid from a crystallographic map building perspective, that actually gives you fewer degrees of freedom, and you could do it in that context. And then you could map your data into sort of a gestalt of different, you know, conformations, right, which are supported by the data. The problem with that is you can't discriminate between the variability of the data, the noise level of the data itself, and true variations of the molecule in solution. So if you see, my data doesn't tell me accurately that this side chain could be here or it could be here, it could be anywhere in this range. So I should say maybe this alpha helical extension, whatever this loop is maybe dangling around in the model. The question is that variation that you're observing because of the uncertainty in your data, or is it because it's actually moving in solution? And that's a very hard question to answer. I think we could incorporate molecular mechanics into our refinement strategy relatively easily right now. We've played around with that a couple of times in the past. I think various people have tried various things, but it's pretty hard to distinguish that at that last level. And if you can't tell the difference between those two things, then it's not clear what you're going to accomplish. I'm not saying there's no solution. I'm just saying I don't have it.
To follow up on what Steve just said, I'm not sure whether it would answer your question, but about a decade ago, I entertained the idea of making model building part of EM structure determination, and actually I still believe it's the future. 10 years ago, it wasn't feasible. EM maps were not good enough. Data was not good enough. But now it's quite possible. You see, to refine the molecular model concurrently with the refinement of the map. I think that's how it will be done in the future. And then one can build in all sorts of safeguards, I guess, that you're asking for into this entire procedure.
Sure, I feel a little silly asking a technical question after a big philosophical discussion, but maybe I'll hide it in a discussion of map validation and resolution assessment and masking. So my technical question to George is that the phase randomization test, you build a map and refine it, and then you randomize the phases and refine it and compare the Fourier shell correlations. In Relion, you're not actually re-refining the data with the phases randomized, I presume. Does that have any practical differences in the result?
You can use the high-resolution phase randomization for two different purposes. You can apply it to your data and test how much your
algorithm overfits, and that's useful if you've developed a new algorithm or if you want to test an algorithm you've plucked from the web somewhere, okay? And we also misuse the same procedure to measure what's the effect of masking on the FSC curve. So there is no refinement involved in that. It's very quick. You have two unfiltered half maps. You calculate an FSC curve. Then you apply a mask. You calculate an FSC curve. Then Steve shows that goes up. Part of it is real. Part of it isn't. Now you can randomize the phases in both half maps beyond the given resolution and apply the same mask. Now, if there is any correlations beyond the resolution where you've done that phase randomization, then that's only due to convolution of lower frequencies into those frequency because of the effect of the map. And then you can, and this correction equation is the same as for the refinement one, and it's given in this Chen et al. Ultramicroscopy 2013 paper. You can actually correct the FSC curve for the effects of the convolutions and maintain the effect of the solvent flattening. To a reasonably acceptable extent.
It's very useful. So that means you're removing the effects of the masking, but not any overfitting effects.
This is nothing to do with overfitting.
Right, okay.
Yes.
Shall I go? Okay. I'll get back on. We need to measure as much what we know and what we don't know. There's a nice tool in Scipion actually, just for measuring the CTF. We don't have a measure of the error of the CTF estimation, and it's quite important. And they have that tool where you can run different parameters or different programs and then measure the difference between two different calculations, and that will tell you exactly how far they agree in terms of resolution. And if they agree only up to 8 angstrom, you can just throw away your micrograph, for example. But it might be too simple, but it might give us some idea of the error in CTF estimation.
It's a question for Nico. You were talking about the repeated classification. How many times do you think you can do that, and when do you stop without overinterpreting your data?
You can carry on with this cascade that I showed as much as you want. I guess at some point your resolution will suffer. Or you get classes that are not really different from each other anymore.
So that's what I meant. Do you compare your classes in which term? How do you do the comparison between the different classes, and when do you judge that?
How can you determine if classes are different from each other?
For example.
Yeah, well, that's, I guess, a somewhat harder question. But you could, for example, calculate difference maps, then ask if the differences are significant, because you also know, or should know, the noise in your individual maps. Okay. Could I say something about the Wishaw correlation calculation with masking? So you don't actually have to mask in order to get a Wishaw correlation that only depends on the density. You should be able to adjust the Wishaw correlation curve that is calculated with a bigger mask to one that you would have gotten with a tight mask, and then not run into these problems. I mean, there is a price to pay, which is it's a little more noisy. But you could do that. So Freeland does this. The other thing is, I think it's important to distinguish between overfitting and the behavior of the Fourchard correlation curve. I mean, we talked about this, but in your talk, I believe it was not separated.
Yeah, I'm puzzled by this fact that you don't see the same particles show up in the classification between reliant and free align. And so my question is, if you could use this for your advantage, if you have two different samples, one with a ligand and one without, or one with some subunit or so, and the other one without, and you record images of both on the same microscope, but on different days on the different grids. So you know which particles belong to one class and which particles belong to the other class. Then you mix them and you try to separate them with Reliant and with FreeAlign. The question is on which program would be better in finding the truth. And these two use slightly different norms, metrics, if I'm right. And maybe you could use this to fine-tune the metric.
But you have to have a separation. I mean, you have to define how different they are. Right. I mean, if you do something that's got a very large ligand versus something that's very small, that will make the problem easier or harder. Right?
Can you pause the
yeah.
One could also do phantom calculations, right? Then we know the true character of the particle.
So I think there is always a true character of a particle, right? A particle is either in state one or in state two. There is no in-between state if you have two different classes in reality. Now, that's a different thing. I thought Nico in the beginning went really in the right direction when he showed these two Gaussian curves, and he said, you can't really, some of the blue and the red ones, you can't tell apart because of noise in the data. So noise in the data makes it impossible for some particles to really be sure whether it's one state or the other state. That means that all your classification assignment will be stochastic. Even if you do an experiment of mixed data sets, even there you will see that you'll be making some problems. There might be some bias in the different data sets might be different which might mask this a bit. But if you do the true experiment, you will always make mistakes, as you always make mistakes in alignment. So 60% overlap, I think, is pretty good. If you'd rely on another second, on you get a different random initial subset, and you get a different class, I would be happy with 60% overlap. It doesn't mean that the particles that then FreeAlign finds that Reliant didn't find were right or wrong. It's all about how well can you model that distribution, and can you find the distribution as a whole? Can you find the mean? And so the irreproducible results, as it was kind of in between brackets, wasn't irreproducible because the map was the same map. And whether it's particle per particle exactly the same, you're always going to make mistakes there.
Here's the iron fist. Okay. Yeah, thank you very much. I mean, this was a terrific panel discussion.